all this week, Central Time is taking a deep dive into key issues in immigration in the United States. Today, we focus on children and youth, oftentimes fleeing violence, arriving alone at the United States border. There's been a surge in unaccompanied minors in the last few years, many of them coming from Central America, where facing the arduous journey north can look safer than the gang-related violence facing them in their home countries, places like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. These kids can range from very young to late teens, and upon arrival in the United States, they face an uncertain future as they enter the legal system. Our next guest is here to talk about the situations many of these kids are in and her work representing unaccompanied minors in immigration court. Uzumaka Enzalibe is a clinical associate professor of law at the Northwestern University School of Law and a staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. Uzumaka, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob, for having me on.
Well, Uzumaka, there's been a lot of attention in the news lately on kids separated from their families at the border. We've talked about that a lot on the show. Talk, though, about unaccompanied minors arriving at the border without their families in the first place.
So it's good to draw a distinction between kids who actually travel to the United States alone and attempt to enter the United States by themselves or are caught along the border alone versus the children who may have come to the United States with a parent and then because of the administration's policies have become separated from their parents. So my clinic, we represent unaccompanied children, so people who attempt to come into the United States by themselves. And we have a system sort of set up to process these kids. And so that's kind of what I do and what I've been doing for the last 14 years.
Can you talk about what happens after that arduous journey from Central America for a youth? You write that you often work with people in their teens. What happens when they hit the U.S. border?
So what happens is that their first interaction, usually, if they're apprehended at the border, their first interaction is with someone from Customs and Border Protection. And when they're apprehended, a decision has to be made about whether or not they'll be returned or transferred into the custody of HHS, or the Health and Human Services. And the organization or the agency within HHS that's responsible for the custody of these kids is the Office of Refugee Resettlement. So when they encounter a CPB officer, the first thing the CPB officer has to determine is whether or not this child is accompanied or unaccompanied. And so if the child is unaccompanied, the next step is to try to figure out, is this child from a contiguous country, such as Mexico or Canada, but it's usually Mexico, or from a non-contiguous country like the three Central American countries that are kind of in play, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And so when if a determination is made that they're from a non-contiguous country, so let's kind of move down that path rather than the contiguous path. But if they're from a non-contiguous country, then the CPB officer has to transfer that child into the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. When that child gets into ORR custody, they're detained until an official there is able to find a family or relative who's in the United States, and that child is reunified with that family member. Even though the child is allowed to be reunified with that family member, it doesn't mean that their immigration case has gone away. We then step in and represent those kids who've been released to family members in the Chicagoland area or who have cases in the Chicago Immigration Court. And so the Chicago Immigration Court kind of covers a couple states. So it covers Illinois, Wisconsin, and Indiana. And occasionally we might get a kid from, like, Southwest Michigan who also needs representation.
What kind of representation, then, do they need? What are they advocating for? Is it asylum status at that point that they're trying to get?
So most kids that come across the border are fleeing violence. And when you're fleeing violence, you can be fleeing sort of different forms of violence, right? So you can imagine that some of my clients are fleeing sort of domestic violence, so violence in the home. Either there's been an abusive parent or a neglectful parent or a parent that's abandoned the child. And those kids will qualify for a special type of relief called special immigrant juvenile status. And that type of relief is kind of a two-step process. So the first step is to sort of go to a state court and ask the state court to do what it normally does, which is make a determination that this child has been harmed by a parent. And then once you have that decision, then you can go back to an immigration agency and ask for immigration relief. So that's one path, the special immigrant juvenile status, and that path is for kids who may have been abused by a parent. Then the second category of cases that we see are kids who qualify for asylum. And by the way, they're not mutually exclusive. So often kids that we represent are eligible for SIJ or asylum. And our asylum laws are designed to help people who have either suffered some type of harm in their home country or are afraid to return to their country because they are fearful that they will suffer harm.
Talking to Uzumaka Enzalibe from the Northwestern University School of Law, looking at unaccompanied minors and the U.S. immigration and legal system. Uzumaka, you've worked with some of these youth, often teens, who have come into the country. Can you just share some of the stories you hear from them about why they set out from their home country, I think it's known as a dangerous journey across Mexico and an uncertain conclusion at the U.S. border? What is there motivating them?
So typically, my clients are coming because they're afraid to live in their communities. They're coming from communities that are gang-controlled. So, you know, when I hear the president talk about the MS-13 and sort of rail against MS-13, what I want to say is that a lot of my clients have been saying the same thing about the MS-13, and the MS-13 is a notorious gang that operates in much of Central America. And so maybe a gang has approached my client because of their age and because they live in a neighborhood that's controlled by that gang, and the gang has sort of given them a choice. The gang has said, you know, we want you to join. And the gang, it's not purely just instrumental. So the gang doesn't just need more people to kind of do its dirty work. The gang may want you to join because it's a good way to sort of like silence opposition, right? So we want to know who on our turf is for us. And if you're not in our gang, we're going to assume that you're not for us. So a lot of my clients who are like 14, 15, 16 have been approached by the gang at some point in time to join. And the choice isn't join, and if you don't want to join, go back to doing what you're doing. The choice usually is join, and if you don't join, die. And so when the child is presented with that option, they feel like they have no choice but to leave and come to the United States and seek safety. For my girl clients, you know, sometimes the gang may say, I want you to be my girlfriend, and if you don't do it, then, you know, we will sexually assault you. And so these are tough choices for 15, 16-year-olds. They're not leaving their countries because, and walking across deserts and hopping on trains just for a slightly better life. The reason why they're coming is because they feel that if they remain in their countries, they will die. And when I talk to kids, what they want, you know, a lot of my kids will tell me, I just want to go to school. I want to feel safe and be able to wake up and go to school. And when they come here, I just attended a graduation in June, and I have to tell you, this kid came here when she was 12, and she didn't speak a word of English. She graduated top of her class, and I was just so proud of her. And it's amazing because when kids are safe, they thrive. And that's what most of these kids want, are just to be safe so that they can be productive.
Uzumaka Enzalibe is with us. She's a clinical associate professor of law at the Northwestern University School of Law and a staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. She's with us to talk about unaccompanied minors who are in the United States aiming to seek asylum and the legal hurdles they have to clear. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the process that unaccompanied minors go through to gain entry and remain in the United States? What do you want to know about policies governing accompanied minors in the U.S. and how that may have changed? If this has been your story or the story of someone in your family, we'd love to hear from you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our immigration series this week, looking now at unaccompanied children and their long path as they seek asylum here in the United States. Uzumaka Enzalibe is with us, clinical associate professor of law at the Northwestern University School of Law and staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is there something you find confusing about unaccompanied minors and the process they go through when they arrive at the border? What questions do you want answered? Have you had an experience with this system yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Uzumaki, there have been changes under the Trump administration, of course, and the Justice Department has said, hey, for refugee status, we are going to be not considering things like domestic abuse and gang violence, those two categories you were talking about earlier, as qualifying cases for refugee status, asylum status as well, I think. Can you clarify what I just said there and make sure I have that all right, and tell us if that's affecting the kind of clients you work with?
Yes, it certainly is. It's squarely the problem that we're going to be having going forward. So let me just sort of back up and tell you a little bit about our asylum laws. There are sort of five reasons why you can seek asylum, and, you know, some are like race, religion, political opinion, nationality, and social group. So you can kind of think about race and nationality are like things that you cannot change, right? So your race, you can't magically become another race. And if someone is going after you because of your race, you can come to the U.S. and seek protection. The other two, political opinion and religion, are sort of a nature, are things that we shouldn't make you change, right? Because they're so fundamental to who you are that we shouldn't make you change it in order to avoid persecution. Now, social group has been read to kind of be like the other categories, right? So a social group are people who have characteristics either that they should not be made to change or cannot change. And so a lot of the kids cases, unaccompanied kids cases from Central America, sort of fit into this social group category. And there's been a lot of, like, this category is the most ambiguous, it's the most difficult category to kind of, you know, predict where the law is going. The other thing I want to tell you about our asylum laws is that, you know, there are two types of cases, right? So the classic case that people kind of think of is like government persecution. So the government comes out and is going after you. But there's another category of cases that involves when the government cannot or will not protect you from a private persecutor. So the second category of asylum cases are sort of called private persecution cases. So cases involving Central American kids or youth usually are social group cases and are also private persecution cases. Now, the Attorney General has issued a decision that's contrary to sort of longstanding asylum jurisprudence about, and basically has said that he doesn't think that almost a categorical approach rather than a case-by-case analysis, and has stated that he feels that kids who are coming from Central America don't meet the social group definition, and also that the types of harms that they're suffering are criminal and rather than sort of government persecution or a situation where the government is not able to prevent their persecution. So all of this sort of makes it difficult for us to sort of go forward. But my belief is that I think that that the Attorney General cannot, by the stroke of a pen, upend our asylum jurisprudence. And so we will continue to bring these cases forward and try to sort of work them through our courts, both sort of the immigration court, the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is the next level, and then finally to the Seventh Circuit and the Supreme Court, because I do feel that what the Attorney General has done is sort of incredibly, it's contrary to our asylum laws and is inconsistent with prior decisions in these cases.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up, Jerry?
Well, I want to know where the law enforcement and where the safety asylum is in the Central America region, because why do these kids have to come 1,000 miles or more north to get into our country illegally to seek asylum? Where's the protective order of law enforcement in Central America?
Jerry, thanks for that call. So, Uzumaki, this is a problem that Jerry thinks is real but should be solved where it's happening.
That's a great question, you know, and I think that is you know, like I started out by saying that our asylum laws allows people to come and seek protection when their government cannot protect them. And that's exactly what's going on in Central America. So these kids are coming from incredibly weak states. What you'd want to imagine is that some of these kids live in neighborhoods where the gangs control them completely and have sort of become a substitute government in those neighborhoods, right? So they're so strong, there's so many gang members that the police and the security personnel in those countries lack the ability to protect the kids. And so that's the reason why they're not able to sort of seek the protection of their government. Yes, asylum is an extraordinary remedy. It's the situation where a country steps in to protect the citizens of another country and will only do it if the government is persecuting the person or if the government is unwilling or unable to protect the people who are being harmed. And that's the situation with the Central American children.
Jerry, thanks for that. Thanks a lot for that call. And Uzumaki, I think a concern from the Trump administration and others is that if we send signals that we're very willing to accept youth for asylum status here, we'll be encouraging more to take a dangerous journey there, maybe overwhelming the Border Patrol's ability to police the border, that we would be encouraging too many people to come north to the United States.
So the floodgates argument is sort of something that's always been there. But if you take a look at our asylum laws, they envision large groups of people, right? So I initially said that people can come here and seek protection if they're being persecuted because of their race, because of their religion. All of these are really large categories. And so we wouldn't say to a group if they're being persecuted because they are they're black or they're a Hutu ethnicity, that there are just too many of you, so it's okay for you to remain in your country and be killed, right? We would never say that. And so if we think of that, if we kind of think about why we have these laws, right, and they're designed to protect people who really fear for their lives, right, then I think the floodgates issue kind of comes into perspective. Now I hear you. I think that we do have to have sort of a long-term approach, right? So it can't be I think the Trump administration has to engage those governments, has to sort of help them solve the issues that are causing, that are driving the kids to come to the United States. But that isn't something that's going to happen overnight. That is a long-term, serious engagement so that folks don't feel that they need to come. But in the meantime, it's difficult to turn kids away when they say what will happen to them is that they're going to die.
Talking to Uzumaki Enzalibe from the Northwestern University School of Law, looking at unaccompanied minors in the U.S. immigration and asylum system. Uzumaki, you represent, you give legal representation to these youth. You also see them as people in a different new place, in a different country, fleeing violence. Can you talk about what kind of experiences you see from the youth you work with?
You know, I find my clients' stories so inspiring. It makes me feel that the humans are truly resilient. I work with kids who all they want is just to go to school, and they come here, and they have the opportunity, and they do well. I have kids that tell me that because the law enforcement has failed them in their country, that their one and only desire is to become a police officer to keep other people safe. I don't see them as hordes. I don't see them as an influx. I see them as young people who want an opportunity to be safe so that they can be productive. And I go to graduations, I go to quinceañeras, I go to different events because I just find that they're people and that they're people who just want a chance. They want to be safe. I can't say that enough, that most of my clients, all they're asking for is to be safe. They want to be safe so they can go to school. They want to be safe so that they can make it to their 16th birthday. They want to be safe so they don't have to be a prostitute. They want to be safe. That's all they're really asking for is just safety.
And briefly, as we wrap up, is there enough legal representation out there for these youth?
No, there really isn't. And what we're finding is that having an attorney makes a whole lot of difference. It keeps engaged. If we're concerned about kids not showing up for court, the best way to remedy that is to give them a lawyer. Also, but having an attorney depends on a lot of arbitrary things. It depends on whether or not you have a relative that lives in an urban area that's well-resourced, that means that there's a nonprofit around to give you pro bono lawyers. And so our laws say that kids, that immigrants don't have a right to court-appointed attorneys. So what we're saying is that kids have to go to immigration court and represent themselves. And I'll tell you, as someone who sort of works with law, second and third year law students, that our asylum laws are incredibly complicated. And the idea that there could be a kid out there representing themselves sort of like, it makes me cringe, because I know that they're fighting impossible odds. So we don't have enough lawyers, and we don't have enough people who representing these children. And it's unfortunate given how difficult these laws are.
Uzumaka, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Uzumaka Enzalibe is a clinical associate professor of law at the Northwestern University School of Law and a staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. She joined us today to talk about unaccompanied minors in the U.S. immigration system and what they have to do to gain asylum here in the country. Tomorrow, in our final interview of our immigration series, we look at the role politics plays in the immigration debate and how it's used on both sides of the aisle. Also tomorrow, WPR is teaming up with the CBC for a cross-border show on trade and tariffs this weekend. We'll share the details, meet my Canadian co-host for that special. And by the way, you can get in on the conversation right now with a call to our callback line at 833-424-3327. Do tariffs affect you? If you're a dairy farmer, are you worried about the Canadian pricing system? Do you see tariffs in whatever work you're in affecting your job? Let us know. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.